Hello, this is Brad Rao again at the BradRaoMusic.com, and today we are going to be talking about the history of Western music. I wanted to make a different video about music theory, Western music theory, and how that is distinct from other ways of writing music that existed basically in any other country across the world. For this case, I want to focus specifically on the Western history. We're not going to be looking at how that has developed over time and the various trends that happen. And we're going to just see a long series of rebellions. We're going to see a lot of things coming into style to the point where they get cliched, and then people stop doing them altogether, and then people do exactly the opposite, and then embracing that into the point where people get sick of doing that, and eventually things are going to come in and out of style altogether, and it's going to be kind of interesting to watch different ideas bounce around and bounce back. So in the Middle Ages, and we're going to skip over the Greek music because I don't know a lot about it, and as far as I know, it sounds like mankind in general doesn't know that much. I have a feeling that probably we're learning more about it today than before, but there's a, you know, it's so foreign to us that it's really hard to even try to do this. So, you know, this is already, by adopting this Western music thing, we're already adopting a gigantic bias, which ignores what all of the other countries were doing and all different folk music styles. So I just want to point that out. And I have another video that I think I'm going to, another podcast that I'm going to very clearly more elaborately explain that kind of idea. So starting at the Middle Ages, the first thing that we were writing down, first of all, I don't think this is the history of music, but this is the history of music being written down, of course, that we wouldn't know what anyone did back then until they had a notation, and they would only bother notating things if they thought it was important. And if you consider the cost of paper and the amount of work, things were only notated. Not every song that you write you would notate. It's not like today where I have scratchbooks of just random ideas or trying to write songs that even we see in Beethoven trying to write stuff and having it not work out and having him have to scribble it out, which is an interesting insight into the mind of someone back then that we don't really have that luxury in the Middle Ages. So we really only know about what is being written down. And most of the music that we have that's being written down is church music, religious music. For the Catholic Church, in a very general sense, there seems to be a lot of single voice writing, and the idea of the Gregorian chant as being a single voice sang unaccompanied is something that is presented in your standard music history class. There is a lot of evidence, as I found out in a class at NEC, where there's actually a lot of counterpoint and a lot of other different things going on. And again, it's very hard to generalize. It would be very hard to say that everybody in the 90s did such and such. If you've been in the 90s, you might not have ever done that, whatever it happens to be, you know. Or if you think about not, you know, we make these overgeneralizations about periods, but at any given moment, probably a lot of people do that. Like if disco was very popular, but there was still that underground Allman Brothers movement that really was a rejection against disco that was going on at exactly at the same time. Although maybe not as popular or not presented to the masses in the same way. So that's, you know, to be able to talk about history at all, we're going to have to make generalizations. Otherwise, I can't say anything or I have to apologize. But I think that needs to be said too. So usually the looking at music evolves from singing solo lines and then turning that into singing in parallel fifths or singing in parallel fifths and octaves, which was a very popular style that was going on for a long time. Coming in middle ages and working into the Renaissance a little bit, there was this indulgence in parallel fifths and parallel octaves. That was not the other thing. There are other styles where things were using sixths or thirds, and I used to know all the fancy names for that. But I think the interesting thing that I really want to emphasize right now is that for a period of 50 to 100 years, an entire generation of people were writing, starting out in Western tonality, were writing like pretty much all parallel fifths and octaves. They would have everything moving in a parallel fifth and octave almost the entire time, just over and over again, parallel fifths and octaves. That was the sound. And everybody wanted that sound, and once you got that sound, everybody wanted that sound. And this parallel fifth octave sound was huge, and once that caught on, everyone else wanted to get it. And eventually, everyone was doing it. And the hipsters wanted to move away from parallel fifths or octaves. But the problem is, they couldn't. And also, and parallel sixths and thirds to a subtler degree. Again, I'm making gigantic overgeneralizations. If you know a little bit about music theory, you'd realize that. But I'm going to kind of skip over a lot of this because in the discussion, I'm focusing on things I think are interesting. So these hipster guys were tired of the parallel fifths and octaves. Everyone was doing it all the time. And then, even the uncool kids were doing it. So the cool kids had to do something different. And because single note melodies was where they came from, so they couldn't do single note melodies because that's way old school, and I'm sure some of those old school folks were doing that. But really, to progress forward, we had to move away from parallel fifths and octaves, and we had to move away from single notes too, which leads into the idea of an independent voice, where one voice would move not necessarily just in a parallel way but in an independent way, and that in a very general sense, is kind of what happened in the Renaissance. So here we have, and by the time of the Baroque period, and even Bach is known to say, but let's not get too ahead of ourselves, by the time of the Renaissance, we had people who weren't writing any parallel fifths or octaves eventually. And they had this unbelievably elaborate system where you would never write a parallel fifth or an octave, which is an obvious rejection against the previous generation who was just essentially indulging on that and everything, so it's unbelievable. There are treatises that talk about how to go out of your way to write music where you can do whatever you want except for the parallel fifths and octaves. That was a huge thing to try to avoid because that was the older sound and people were trying to distinguish themselves from the older sound. So they almost had to go out of their way to avoid those. And actually, one of the rules in counterpoint today, which has lasted for hundreds of years, is the no parallel fifths and octaves, which really began in the Baroque period, has its roots in the Renaissance, and worked its way all the way up until the late Romantic, until the modern era came around, where that concept was not necessarily thrown away, but just sort of became irrelevant. And of course, we're going to see Debussy. We're going to visit him later. So that's how, the Renaissance music was also known to be very intricate, and they would have these melodies. They would have a certain melody happening and then other melodies being over top of that. And if we look at the order of what happens, for a while the melody was called the tenor. And the tenor was usually the inner line. So during this period, again, for a long part of history, the quote-unquote melody was actually an inner voice. People were focusing on that center voice in between the low voice and the high voice. And the high voice and the low voice were supplemental, unimportant voices. And the tenor and the alto was added later, so we have soprano, alto, tenor, bass. So that inner tenor voice was actually considered the most prominent thing. And that went on for a while, and eventually people got sick of that, and they started saying, well, we're going to put the bass is going to have the melody. And that happened for a while. And then eventually we had, over time and over trial and error, we had this thing, you know, coming back to that, I think, in the Gregorian chant, the lower voice was actually the primary voice, typically, and other voices were added over top, as far as I can tell. So coming into the Baroque music with the figured bass is we have the bass line is the fundamental writing block and the part that you would listen to, and then everything is built on from the bottom up. So instead of in the Renaissance, where we have the middle voice being primary, and again, in general, there's a whole lot of swaying, and even if you know a little bit about history, you realize the subcategories within this that I really don't want to get into. This is going to be probably way too long anyway. So I apologize for that. I'm not, I am ignoring that, but I realize that I am, at least. So now we have, in the Baroque period, this bottom-up kind of thing, where the bass is the foundation of the music, and then we have this figured bass, where essentially music was notated with a bass line and then numbers. And the melody line was not fixed. The melody line was not even important. In fact, it was really, the melody line could have been a number of different things, depending on what chord inversion you decided to start with, whether it be open or closed, and which note you decided to be on the top, the root, the third, or the fifth. So that's a very interesting thing, moving now to the bass being the primary thing. And eventually, more in the classical, and the Baroque period definitely had this too, where there's the idea of the melody, and the melody is on the top. And this is something that is prevalent today, and began in, there's elements of it in Renaissance, and definitely coming to fruition in the Baroque period, but I think in the classical period it's very, very clear that the top line is the melody line. The top line is the thing that gets stuck in your head. It has that catchy little thing, and the inner voices are now the unimportant voices, and the bass voice is really there to support the melody, so that the entire thing is melody based from the top. Not to say that it was written from the top down, although sometimes in this case it would be where you would have a melody and you would harmonize it, as opposed to coming up with a chord progression that happened to create a melody. So already looking from the Renaissance, coming through the classical period, and again, I'm making gigantic overgeneralizations, as I've mentioned, probably even more so than typical historians, but it is interesting to know that there was one point in time where the middle voice was the most important voice, the one that everyone knew and sung and were listened for, and then eventually the bass voice wasn't necessarily the sung one, but with Baroque music, they were notating it based on the bass, and then in the classical period, we have this very strong emphasis on the melody being the catchy thing. And again, this is, you know, there are plenty of examples of this other happening, but I'm really talking about styles indulging mostly into these kind of things. It's not to say that Bach didn't use inner voices or that he didn't have melodic material. But if really, if you look at Bach, you know, each voice, I think, in Bach is equally important, and the idea that the top voice is more important than the inner voices, I think, is really not the way that I think you should be listening to Bach. I think a lot of people have trouble listening to Bach because they're listening for a melody. They're listening for the melody. They're listening for the tune. And the problem is there isn't a the tune. There's many different tunes that are supposed to interact. And not at maybe at a given moment, one might be more important than the other. But if you listen to Mozart and Beethoven, even in the symphonic works, there's usually, at any point in time, again, generally speaking, a single point where the melody, there is a melody, and it's very typically on the top. It doesn't always have to be on the top, but there is the idea of a single melody. So in the Baroque period, we have a bunch of melodies that are equally important. In the Renaissance, there was that too. I think that they did have one melody that they're kind of looking to getting across. In the Baroque period, they're kind of trying to have all the melodies be equal, and based from the ground up. And if you think about the cultural implications of having the lower levels being built up the top levels. As opposed to in a classical era where the top levels work, you find out what they're doing, and then you work your way downward. That could potentially have political, maybe like subconscious political implications. Here we are now at the classical period. So first of all, we got rid of singing by ourselves. We went through the parallel fifths. We're done with that. We're over that. That's so old. Nobody's doing that. And then the Renaissance part where the inner voice is important. Now the inner voice isn't important at all. And we also rejected, we have this Baroque idea where all of the voices are equally important, and we've rejected that now where we have a melody voice, which is very typically on the top, which is the primary voice, and the other voices are really just there to support the melody. It's not to say that counterpoint isn't there. In Beethoven, there's quite a bit of counterpoint and some fugues even, or fugal type events within a piece. I should say, he doesn't just strictly write fugues as far as I know. We're into this classical period, and that so all those things are happening. And now how do the new hipsters be cool now? Okay, because like so far we don't want to bring anything back yet. Okay, so the Romantic era now coming into the 1800s, we now have to do something cool, and we have to reject the ideas. The idea of the melody primarily being on top, that's actually going to stick. And the other accompanying voice with the bass kind of implying the chord, that's actually going to stick. That's something that is more of an undercurrent of music that, because it's not, it takes a lot longer for people to get tired of it, I think. It took a couple hundred years for people to get that, having that sound be kind of worn out and, you know, well, I've heard all that before. So those things are going to stick. But the difference now is going to be in how far we are taking things. First of all, in terms of length of pieces, Beethoven, starting with the Third Symphony, hinting at it with the Fifth Symphony, and blatantly coming out and saying it at the Ninth Symphony, like, I'm making like a major work. Beethoven would probably want to write a piece that was a couple days long, except nobody would be able to stay awake long enough for that if he were to continue his trajectory. And I would be very interested if human beings wouldn't be even able to appreciate it. But, we all have limitations, even Beethoven. But he was still able to do these tremendously long pieces. The other thing that's going further is the modulations. If you look at, if you start in medieval music, I don't think the music really modulates at all. I don't even think the idea of a modulation even occurred to them. And if you look at the Renaissance, you might see a modulation. In fact, you might even see some weird chromatic mediate modulations at one point. Coming into the Baroque era, And there's very conservative modulations, and that because in the early Baroque era there was still the mathematical Pythagorean mean tone, different types of tunings, perfect fifth tunings that really a lot of your instruments you couldn't really play in different keys. On the keyboard you were limited. When you're playing a flute, recorder, clarinet type instrument, usually those are based in one key, and it becomes increasingly difficult. String instruments usually favor the keys of the open string. A violin player might play in the key of E a lot, and the key of A, and the key of D, and the key of G, as do guitar players and bass players. Those are common keys because we have open strings. So there's a, and especially on the keyboard, there was certain keys were easier to play on certain instruments, and that tended to happen more. And with the limits of the tunings, there wasn't the possibility of a lot of key change. So if you look at Baroque music, as much as I love Bach, his key changes are very conservative. He'll modulate, really, if he's in the key of C, he'll really only modulate to a key within a different key, but only one or two spaces across the circle of fifths, or I'll modulate to a different chord in the key. For example, in C major, we have C major, D minor, E minor, F, G, A minor, and nobody would in that style modulate to a 7 half diminished chord. That was not really a thing back then. That was way too much. Nobody would ever do that. until Les Claypool. But during that time, that was even too radical, even for these new ideas. So Bach would really only modulate to keys that are very close and very convenient, and none of his key changes were really that drastic. A lot of times Bach would change keys and you didn't even know it until the cadence or until you got back, and sometimes it's hard to tell if Bach was using a secondary dominant or if he modulated. And the different criterias, I've heard the criteria that if it's the secondary dominant twice in a row, then it's a modulation. If it's once, it's a secondary dominant. But what about, how long it is, or like if it's at the end of a phrase? And I think that there's a His modulations are smooth and subtle, and it's also, common chord modulations or within a melodic line. Sometimes it's very, very hard to tell the exact moment where Bach modulated. Actually, a lot of times it's very difficult to pinpoint really at all. Even sometimes within a measure, or even the measure that actually caused the modulation. Most people would say that there's definitely a moment when you're it's quite obvious you modulated, but it also built up like that before. You could go back a couple chords before and say that the last three chords were actually in the new key, and I didn't realize it until I got here. As much as you could say those chords were in the key that I was in before. So there's that kind of common ground ninja modulation almost that happens in Bach's time. And moving forward into the classical period with Mozart, the modulations started to be a little bit more drastic. There started to be common note modulations where you could go a little bit further. There was a little bit more of a surprising kind of modulation. Modulating to D flat, which is something that apparently Mozart did and then Sor copied in his Grand Sonata, where he modulated very, very far across the circle of fifths, almost to the opposite end. And it almost became a game to see how far you could modulate. And the idea, some of them were subtle, but, now, when we get into Beethoven, especially, Beethoven's modulations are drastic, and they're in your face. When he wants you to be surprised that you're in that key now. How did we get here? Now, it's not to say that Beethoven is completely radical, because he still has quite a bit of conservative modulations. Apparently, Beethoven wanted to study with Mozart, but ended up studying with Haydn instead, and spent most of his time learning how to lead a five chord to a one chord, which is pretty incredible. Just to, you know, you still don't know how to go from five to one. And if you look at Beethoven's writing, still a lot of it is rooted in that 5-1. And I think that Haydn did a great thing for Beethoven to teach him how to voice lead from 5 to 1. But as an exception to that too, he'll have very surprising modulations that are really, really going crazy. And by the time of the Romantic period, people were modulating to all kinds of stuff, playing the Schubert Arpeggione Sonata and modulating to the Neapolitan for 4 measures in the first phrase is not something that would happen in Bach or even in the classical period, of just like very freely, oh, now we're in this key. And then we're back, and having a 1 Neapolitan 5-1 chord progression happening over the course of really the first page or two, page and a half, is pretty incredible, for Schubert in the Romantic period. So these modulations to distant keys by the time of the Romantics, I think, was really taken for granted. And the shock value that Beethoven created out of being like out of changing keys, people became used to it, and it didn't have the shock value, and it was almost becoming expected by that point. To distinguish even more with the Romantic period, because we haven't quite got tired of the whole no parallel fifths. We've heard parallel fifths for so long, so we're still like, let's keep that. No parallel fifths, we're going to keep that. The melody is going to still be on top. The dynamics are changing a lot more. The keys are changing a lot more. And really, actually, there is a shift in philosophical premise moving from generally to the 1700s to the 1800s, and the idea, you know, coming into, and again, I'm going to have to generalize, the Baroque era was still a very religious era. Bach was very into Luther, and there was a very divine aspect of music. Music was, you know, people would talk about being inspired by God during that period, you know, and that was, you know, I think more than just a common phrase. And if you listen to that kind of music, I know what you mean. It kind of comes from that divinity within, that undivided divinity within all of us. And you can definitely, I think that they kind of tap into that. And I think their music can help us tap into that place in ourselves, and also that time period where that idea was so prevalent. And coming into the classical period, there tends to be more classical, was a more of a rational, scientific kind of approach. If you think about the music, the way it worked in the classical, it was almost expressing a perfect kind of music, separate from, you know, almost like the music of truth, of, you know, objective truth, where, you know, almost like a narrator in a story would be telling you what would actually happen, as if there is a thing that actually happened, with an idea and a philosophical idea that gets challenged in the 18th century during the Romantics. So the idea of, you know, and if you look at Newton's laws of motions, I think that classical music really works a lot like Newton, a lot like the science Newton laws of motion, where we can predict very accurately how things move. And I find music theory trying to copy off of that and trying to come up with their own jargon. But the problem is with that is that music can work in any way. Music, where the physical world can only work in a very specific, it only works in a specific way. You don't drop things and they fall up. You drop things and they fall down at 9.8 meters per second squared. That's just, you know, you can measure that on Earth. That's the, you know, so that's, it's a very rigid scientific approach. And the classical, during this entire classical period, they almost like mimicked that as if their way of writing music was correct and as correct as Newton's laws of motion were correct. But in my opinion, I think that that was kind of a different thing. I think that it's a different way to say it's correct. I think that in classical music, it's correct within its own context, where I think that in physics, it's correct because it would be that exact measurement. Maybe you have a different word for what a meter is or a foot or something, but you're still going to find certain things to be very precisely mathematically true. That's the beauty of math, and I think that was kind of coming into this rational classical age. But during the 1800s, starting with Descartes, working into Kant, and we have the idea more of the subjective, where things are not necessarily, and the extreme of subjective philosophy is sort of this matrix type thing where there is no reality and the entire reality is created within your mind, almost like this is a dream. Or a matrix, or some kind of like your mind creating the image themselves, and that things are not objectively real except for just in your mind. And then that was not an idea that really took hold until the 20th century, and look at what kind of things happened during that. But we're moving towards that slowly. With Kant believing that the things were subjective, but still were true, and he explains that, for example, that sugar would be sweet and a lemon would be bitter, and you might learn to like lemons and you might learn to hate sugar, but at no point in time would you ever think that a lemon tastes like sugar, because you would never say that a lemon doesn't have that tangy taste, and you would never say that sugar tastes like a lemon. So he believed that he was hinting at the subjective aspect, where now it's the individual experiencing the world, and it's not necessarily looking at it from like there's an objective truth, but the way that you look at the world is affecting it, and I think the philosopher started to hint at that. Descartes started that even earlier than Kant with his famous phrase, "I think, therefore I am," which really puts you in the center. And if you think about, as opposed to Bach, who was very religious, and trying to write the music of God, or the classical people trying to write just the objectively true music. Now we have this personal truth and this personal experience. Descartes saying, "I think, therefore I am," and Immanuel Kant talking about how you can appreciate things differently by your point of view, so that it becomes your point of view, And if you realize, different people like different bands, different people have different food flavors, people listen to the same music I hear and they don't like it at all, and I'm blown away. So obviously the way that we interpret reality has an effect on that. So in the Romantic era, that really came, what happened then is it was more about the individual experience. It was more about the joys and the sufferings and the up and down of what it felt like inside to be your own person, and not to just kind of have this outer, this is how things work scientifically kind of way. It's not that they necessarily rejected science, but they got more philosophical in thinking about the individual and the individual experience. And a lot of music became more about like a personal thing that was not universal. And I think that in the Romantic era, it was more about finding that that personal thing that really no one has went through, and like trying to get you to feel it. We all have those personal moments, for good or bad, that we want to communicate, and music was the medium in which people were doing that. And the idea that you could do that was really a very new thing in the 1800s that we didn't see up to this point. So we still had a radical shift from classical music, in this case, in a philosophical premise. We still have the melody on the top. We still have no parallel fifths. We have the crazy modulations, which was really just sort of a continuation, of what was happening in the classical and hinting at with Bach. So we see an increased tendency for music to change keys up to this point. And I think Wagner hits a point where he changes keys so much that it's hard to even really say that he's in any key at any point in time, because you might not even ever get to the tonic. And so I think that Wagner took that whole we're gonna take the keys, and and also the length of the music was expanded really, really long. We have Mahler and Bruckner writing symphonies that are unbelievably long. Wagner writing these very personal, these stories of tragedy and hope, and a very, again, from a very personal standpoint. And amazing things, but at this point in time, with especially Wagner, it's really hard. You can't go any further without the whole thing breaking down, without this whole system breaking down. Because once, eventually we're going to have like 10-hour symphonies, and we're going to, there's only 12 keys, and we can't like... We're gonna modulate on every note, and at that point, I can't really imagine that system would really be able to maintain that without completely being transformed. And this is taking us into the 20th century, where now subjective philosophy is really taking hold in the. In the 1900s, first of all, in science now, we have Einstein, and later the quantum physics, which was beginning to give, even scientists were realizing that things, the way that an individual sees something is different than a way another individual, and even the measurements that a person would take would change depending on their size and depending on their speed in relationship to the speed of light. And this was a very transformative thing. Philosophers were also getting completely into subjective philosophy, where the extreme subjective is that there is no objective universe at all, and basically it's a whole dream, or it's a matrix, it's all in your mind, baby, as Jimi Hendrix says in Spanish Castle Magic, it's all in your mind. And if we look at music in the 20th century, we really have a rejection against the system. This whole system of classical theory, which really, as I don't think people realize it, is trying to mimic Newton. I really believe that it's just trying to mimic Newton and Newton's legacy of physics, and having the rules and having fancy things, and you have to do it like this or it isn't right. And as Einstein and the quantum physics really kind of replaced Newton with a more specific, not that it was thrown out, but it gave us a different view, significant exceptions. What happened in music theory was a similar thing, where these rigid rules, we realized that they aren't rules, and that we realized that we're the ones creating the boxes. We're the masters who make the grass green, as Robert Anton Wilson says, quoting a Zen master. We had a complete breakdown. So this breakdown started happening slowly, and it actually, I would say, it started in France with a guy named Claude Debussy, who was around during the Impressionistic movement of Van Gogh, and he was in a similar area, and he is... typically called, his music is called impressionistic, which I think is an amazing description of his music, although he personally hated that term and he didn't want to be clumped in with that kind of thing. But the name stuck. Debussy, first of all, after all of these things, after the complete expansion, you know, Wagner's operas being unbelievably long, and we're changing keys so much that we don't even know what key we're in. So Debussy does some radical things. And this is a radical change. This is also one of the most drastic changes that has happened. So far, these changes have been very subtle and have taken 100 years, about a generation or two each, is when these changes evolve. But in Debussy, we have a drastic thing, and a lot of it is actually coming back to what happened before, where we have, first of all, Debussy is writing parallel fifths and octaves again. In fact, he's indulging in it. He's writing all parallel fifths and octaves. So finally, after, you know, it's been, what, 100, 200 years of not writing parallel fifths and octaves? So that was a cool new sound. That was so out old school that it was a new school. And Debussy was able to do it in a new way, with new instruments and new tech. It was no longer people singing religious music in a church. He had the voice of an entire orchestra, and he had pianos that were perfectly capable of going all the way through the 88 keys beautifully. So he was really able to do new things with this. He also brought back the modes, and this is something that I didn't mention, but coming back into in the Middle Ages, they had the modes, and the version of the modes, the modes they had were Dorian, Phrygian, Lydian, Mixolydian, and Aeolian. Ionian wasn't even a mode for a couple hundred years. And they also had a hypo version. So there was Dorian. And Dorian was the fundamental note, I guess you would say, re, as we would call it. And you might go a little bit low, but you'd go mostly up to the higher octave and then a little bit low. And the hypo-Dorian is a Dorian where you have a couple of the higher notes, but you're more interested in going into that lower register. And each one of the Phrygian, Lydian, Mixolydian, Aeolian had their hyper version too, which was more interested in the lower, going from the octave down instead of going from the top, going from the bottom note up. And that idea, eventually, the Ionian mode came in. In fact, there was someone in the, I don't actually know the year, but they said that the Christian church will never use the seductive sound of the Ionian mode. The Ionian mode, of course, being the major scale, which is absolutely hilarious, because if you've ever been to church, all of the songs are in major. You know, What Child of Mine is like the only minor song I've ever heard in a church. All of these church songs are traditionally major songs, there was an entire time period where people were saying, no, we're not going to use that seductive major scale. And now it's boring. Now we consider it boring and cliche, and that took some time too. And by the time of the Baroque period, we had this kind of dichotomy between major and minor. A lot of people say that classical music is bipolar, and Beethoven's music, I would say, certainly is, especially, and that duality between major and minor. Because of the equal temperament that became popular by the end of Bach's life, we were able to play in 24 different keys, 12 major keys and 12 minor keys. And that was enough. We got rid of the Dorian and that kind of stuff for a couple hundred years, and really, so during this entire Baroque and classical and Romantic period, it was all major and minor scales, and those were really the only scales that people knew existed, I guess, or really were able to use. And if they knew about other things, it was only in a historic context, the old music that, you know, no one is interested in anymore in playing, maybe just preserving the history of it. So by the time of Debussy, we have this tremendous movement back to parallel fifths, and also now the use of modes. And now, because we're not limited to vocal range, we have the approach to modes that most people understand today, which is the major scale starting on different degrees. And now we have major Dorian, Phrygian, Lydian, Mixolydian, Aeolian, and Locrian as the seven modes. And it doesn't matter if you go up or down, there's no superversion because you just cover the entire piano or whatever instrument you're playing with this mode. So here's two old ideas that are brought back in very new ways, in very new colorful ways. And Debussy also supplied us with something that really hasn't ever happened. I would say that he discovered it. I would say it's always existed on the piano, and that's the whole tone scale. So here's a completely new idea. And the interesting thing about the whole tone scale, and something that distinguishes from everything that's here, because the one thing, it's very hard to convince a fish that he's surrounded by water, because it's so obvious you don't realize it's there, that everything was in a key. And the whole tone scale, with every note being a whole tone apart, it's really hard to say that any one note is even as in more important than any other note. And even since the beginning of this whole Western thing, we have the idea of a single note being important and the scale being based on that and moving around. Whether it be modal or the major or minor, we've had up to that point, we don't even realize it, but we've been doing that. And Debussy, with the whole tone scale, really opens up the idea that maybe music doesn't even have to be in a key. And Stravinsky, very short after Debussy, in fact, they met a little bit, Stravinsky was definitely influenced by Debussy a little bit too much, apparently. There was a moment where Stravinsky premiered the Firebird Suite, and Debussy was there, and Stravinsky said, mentioned to Debussy, he's like, "Oh, I was very influenced by you." And Debussy said, "I know, I can tell." Stravinsky was probably moved by that. And the next work that Stravinsky made was called The Rite of Spring, which was an unbelievable shockwave of music. Here, Stravinsky was writing in two keys at the same time. He was writing in multiple time signatures at the same time. And this is something that no one has done. This isn't just a little bit of syncopation. These are two and completely different rhythms. Even written out in different rhythms, so it's a really tremendous, absolute drastic change, which, you know, people, the cliche of throwing vegetables, people were literally throwing vegetables at the premiere of The Rite of Spring. Rite of Spring is one of my all-time favorite pieces of music. It's unbelievable. It's still surprising to this day, even though it's considered mundane, because again, how do you outdo that? The question, how do you outdo that, was figured out by Schoenberg. Schoenberg was interested in writing atonal music, and he experimented with writing very short atonal pieces, and he didn't really get any far with this free form kind of thing. And eventually he came up with a system called the 12-tone system, where each note was used an equal amount of times. He created something that is called the emancipation of dissonance, where he freed dissonance from its need to be resolved. And for Schoenberg, he believed that dissonance, like minor seconds and major sevenths and tritones, are beautiful. And that was really his revelation. A lot of people think that he was writing violent music, a reflection of World War II. Schoenberg, if you can't tell from the name, was Jewish during the time of World War II. In fact, at one point in time, the Reich said that there shouldn't be any 12-tone music, and it was forbidden, which actually I think increased the popularity of 12-tone music. Very few people I know really enjoy 12-tone music, even trained musicians. It's a very far thing. Only people I knew who are very advanced in ear and theory really have the ability to appreciate that. The myth that you can't hear the 12-tone row in a piece of music, I think, is not true. And I think that if you do a little bit of your own homework, you can actually hear the form of the piece taking place. And that's an interesting thing. So the emancipation of dissonance and the freedom for dissonance to no longer resolve, and the idea that each note is going to be literally used an equal amount of time, where you wouldn't use a note until you've used all the other notes, so that every note gets to just be itself without having to be based on that, is a very, very different and new approach, completely a rejection of the tonal system and the attempt to really create a new system. And this new system was carried out even farther by guys like Milton Babbitt, who got into mixing, almost more as mind games, where he would have creating it so that, for example, a tone row might go across vertically and horizontally, almost in the way of that Bach was doing earlier with counterpoint, but in a much more complicated way. But I would say that ultimately, I don't think that this music really caught on with the mainstream. There's still a lot of people writing 12-tone music or writing atonal music, and that's in high art scenes, that is a very, very big thing that is still taking place to this day and has taken place. But I think that it was a little bit too extreme, and I think that it became so analytical that it really lost a lot of people. And I think a lot of people feel that way about modern art, which is just a splattered paint, or Picasso, who's just like that. Oh, people don't look like that. And I've even heard people say that it's a lot easier to appreciate modern art because you can look at it for as long as you want, and when you're tired of it, you get to walk away. And when you go to a classical concert of modern classical music and it's an hour long, you can't just pop your head. Usually you're expected to stay the whole time, and then people would leave anyway. I would imagine that happens all the time, no matter who you are. There was a really isolating themselves from anything that any mainstream or normal person could really approach. So I think that got taken way too far. And then there was so the reaction against that was actually so extreme that we have guys like Philip Glass and Steve Reich, who were interested in writing music that was completely primitive. And in this kind of music, they'll take a simple thing and repeat it over and over again and trying to do different phases, which is a complete rejection against the 12-tone, completely losing people. They have things that, like, how could you possibly get lost? I'm going to tell it to you 1,000 times over and over again. So here again, we see this on and off switch moving in now a different way, where we have a very repetitive approach, a total rejection against that. Now we're dealing with the issues is where do we go now? I think that computers are going to increasingly play a larger role in music making, to the point where I think that it's going to dominate all music making. I mean, of course, people will still play guitar, but people still play the violin and the piano. And I think that the guitar is very quickly going to go the route of the violin, where people will play it, but it's not going, I think the time of the guitar being the king of the instruments, and you turn on the radio and you hear Led Zeppelin and you hear Nirvana and you hear guitar music played by guitar players, that was a great time. And I think that we got a lot out of it. But I even as a guitar player, I'm excited to see what's going to happen and what the next instrument is going to be. So I think electronic music is coming into that, and we're at a strange place now. Everybody is connected, so information is traveling a lot faster, and the industry is changing a lot more too, where the musicians are now independent. Actually, the first independent musician, the first musician who didn't work for a king or a duke as a servant, was actually Beethoven. Beethoven was the first self-employed musician. And nowadays, it's actually very easy to be a self-employed. I'm a self-employed musician, very easily through some lessons, selling some music online, playing some gigs at some local places. And I'm not really doing much, and I'm not on TV or anything amazing, but I'm, more than, making it happen, and that's amazing. And really, Beethoven really began that trend. So technology is happening. Music theory, I think that there's the idea of teaching classical music, like right now, or I shouldn't even say right now, but when I went to undergrad school, there was the way that the curriculum was set up is we had music theory one and music theory two, which was mostly like Baroque classical. Again, I'm overgeneralizing a lot. Music theory three, we got into the Romantic, we got into Neapolitans and augmented sixes and a little bit crazier modulations, diminished chords taking you to weird places. And then the end, the music theory four, which was more of the 20th century stuff. Now, when I've had, teaching students, because I tutor some music theory students, and I noticed that the trend since then has been more of jumping into the Neapolitans and augmented sixes are more stuck into music theory two, and music theory three and four is becoming more of a 20th century thing. So instead of covering the entire 20th century in one semester and covering the classical tradition in 3 semesters, there it's a little bit more equally divided, where we spend more time on the things that we're going to do now. I thought it was a little bit weird that I spent 4 semesters learning how to write in a style and being yelled at if I didn't follow the rules, only to be told in theory four and in composition class, don't ever do any of that. So we were spending a lot of time learning a style that eventually they're telling us not to learn. And if the value of learning it at all, it was just to know what to avoid almost more than in its own merit. I actually personally like the classical style. So it's a weird kind of thing where they're teaching this tradition. So I saw a movement even in my own lifetime. And now what I'm seeing is that people are trying to remove the music theory altogether, something that I personally am opposed to. Maybe I'm just an old man, but some schools are doing where they're going to have 2 years of music, 2 semesters of music theory, and then 2 semesters of entrepreneurial training. And so the music theory and the ear training is actually taking a lesser toll. And I am seeing, there are people who specialize in the classical tradition, but definitely the counterpoint, the way that people wrote counterpoint back in the time of Bach, just I don't think Eliot said the same thing that I'm saying, that essentially I'm telling you what he told me, is that we're not going to have that because people were living and breathing counterpoint all the time. And I can study counterpoint on my lunch break, but I'm not submerged in a counterpoint culture that was thriving in the way that they were. And I'm seeing a trend where classical theory is being pushed aside and being replaced with jazz theory. In fact, there's the jazz theory book. And honestly, there's a reaction against the jazz musicians saying that they're not learning it. In the jazz musicians were more about the individual playing their own way, and now there's a jazz theory. None of these guys, Coltrane and Miles never read a jazz theory book. They played. Miles has a quote where he says, "I'll play it first, and I'll tell you what it was afterwards." But I think that's probably one of the truer jazz theories. Or Charlie Parker, who says, if it sounds right, it is right, which I think is really the only truth in music. And as music goes through time, and we've seen that it has evolved many times. So speaking of jazz, so coming, one of the other things that happened is that there was in America, there was a segregation of race. where, you know, people weren't going to the same schools or using the same water fountains, or even the same bathrooms, and which is actually a lot of work and probably was a very expensive way to avoid your problems. And because of that, there was this tragic division, which in a, again, to, I, as much as I've overgeneralized before, I'm overgeneralizing now, where the, you know, the black culture was more based on improvising, and the classical musicians, almost the reaction against that, where the improvising was completely removed. If you, you know, Bach and Mozart and Beethoven were known to be amazing improvisers, and now the traditional classical musician of today has no idea how to improvise, and all they know how to do is play what's on a page. I've seen amazing piano players who can't even improvise in A minor, which is the white keys. I can even improvise in A minor, and I know nothing about piano, or very little. So where we have this other culture, jazz music and blues music and rock music, which especially jazz was so fundamentally based on improvising. And I think that it was a self kind of feeding thing, because I think the cultures really wanted to separate from each other. The more the one side saw improvising, the more that they wanted to not improvise, and vice versa. And I think that classical music, I believe that that is literally the instant in time that classical music died. That is like whatever, how, you know, when improvising was removed from classical music, and it, there was a split in between, you know, and also the idea of there was also a split in between popular music. So not only was the racial element different, but the because the 20th century music was just so weird and abstract, there was people weren't going to, you know, go into their cars and listen to this stuff. So there was the popular trend in music, which actually had a lot to do with the black influence, which started out with blues, which was very much a folk-based thing. And in blues music, another interesting reversal, which can really be most, I think, best understood in harmonica, is if you were going to play a classical song in harmonica, basically a harmonica, for the most part, except for the higher notes, if you blow into a harmonica, you get a C, and if you draw or breathe in through a harmonica, you get a G7. So you have a C and a G7. And in classical music, the C is the one chord, and the G7 is the tension, and the G7 resolves the classical music. But in this blues approach, we actually had the dominant chord was the primary note, and the C major was the four chord. So now we have a G7 tonic and a C major subdominant four chord, giving us an amen, more of a, you know, and that's kind of the fundamental thing of, so now the dominant chord, which has been a tension for so long, is now really the home in which this blues is taking place. And jazz is taking it even further. You know, if we talk about adding notes, if you look at, again, going through, starting with one note, in the Middle Ages, and then coming into adding the parallel fifth and the octave, and then eventually adding the third, and then in classical music where we have triads, 1, 3, 5, and then moving into a dominant seventh chord. And by the time that we get into jazz, we have chords like major 7 chords, major, we have 9 chords, we have 11 chords, we have 13, and 13 is the highest number. The next note after 13, the next odd number after 13 is 15, which is really just another octave. No one ever talked about a 15 chord. If you had a G chord with a 15, you'd add a G to a G chord, which doesn't really change very much. It's redundant. So we have these unbelievable extensions with, over the course of jazz, have become increasingly popular. And jazz music got so crazy and weird and wacky eventually that, you know, not that it didn't happen, but it became, there was a reaction against that, where we have the rock and roll. And even in rock and roll, we have the power chord, where suddenly, you know, people are moving the 1 and the 5 and the octave up and down again, but this time on guitars and on electric instruments. And that was a different shift, a reaction against the jazz, which was jazz was a reaction against the simplicity of the blues and the, you know, so we see this kind of the shifting of different ideas. And even in rock and roll, when I listen to Elvis, I can't even believe that's rock and roll. It sounds like country to me. You know, what I think of as rock and roll doesn't even, you know, it came a long way, from Elvis. And so these are, you know, I think I'm gonna, I you know, I think I pretty much covered a lot in this, but I think it's really interesting to see that over the course of Western music, and it happens today, it happens in even within genres and on grand scales and on small scales, with these things that become popular and then they're used. And depending on how general or specific they are, a specific thing gets used up and thrown out very quickly, but a general idea takes a lot longer. And we see these ideas of things coming into style and eventually been done to the point where people are completely sick of them. And then they do the exact opposite and then eventually come back. The really interesting thing is looking into the future, looking at all that we've done. Are we going to have a new parameter? Are we going to have a new music theory? Is there going to be a new way that incorporates jazz and modes? Are we finally able to come back and, you know, be brothers and mix the improvising into the classical music again and mix the classical into the improvising again, and we can just have music and it doesn't have to be such a drastic contrast. And I think that would be a very beautiful thing, I think, if we, you know, and I think with computers, you know, there's a lot of new possibilities and a lot of new parameters. But really, you know, still we have the same things coming in style and out of style that's happened so many times. And until there's a new paradigm, we're stuck in this. So I hope maybe you can create that new thing. So thanks for listening.